The Orpheus Chamber Orchestra began its new season at Carnegie Hall last Tuesday with a program, the first half of which reminded me of a Broadway show from the long-ago days when Jude Law was an almost unknown actor, certainly not as famous as his counterpart in that revival of Jean Cocteau's Indiscretions, Cynthia Nixon. The real stars of the show were Kathleen Turner and Eileen Atkins. I remember a lot of Miss Atkins slinking around in skimpy negligees. It was all somewhat improbable. Mr. Law, however, more improbably than most, began the second act dressed in a pair of ankle socks. That was his only gift from the goddess of garments. He rose out of a hip bath, otherwise quite naked, at a time when such full disclosure was still somewhat uncommon on Broadway. I forgot to tell you this, but I was seated behind, I was attending a Wednesday matinee, the only man in the balcony. One woman, seated behind me, whispered loudly to a friend, "I don't know why he bothers reciting his lines. Nobody's paying the least attention to what he's saying." The only word for what Mr. Law was doing is swinging. All right, it wasn't quite like that at Carnegie Hall last Tuesday. But one had a terrible time paying attention to the first half of the program, partly because of the promise or threat of what was to come in the second half, and partly because the program itself bordered on the lunatic. The big deal, of course, was going to be Brahms's D minor piano concerto, with virtuoso Yefim Bronfman on the bench. No concerto could be more at home at Carnegie Hall, but tonight it was going to have to make its way without the help of a conductor, and members of the audience could be forgiven the kind of tingling anticipation that bravura stunts inspire. That a big part of pulling off the stunt of playing Brahms' vastly romantic, thundering and moody magnum opus would be keeping it from sounding like a stunt at all, only added to the excitement. Now, I should have begun the concert with maybe Brahms' Academic Festival Overture, which has been out of circulation for so long that it's almost fresh enough for Orpheus to tackle, and I expect that they'd have given it a very fresh reading, too. Then I'd have slotted a late Haydn symphony, not the miracle or the surprise, but maybe the drum roll of the 98th. So much for my 2 cents, which are offered only as suggestions that might have held the audience's attention, or at any rate, mine. Instead, we began with 3 encores, the 1st, 3rd, and 10th of Brahms's orchestrated Hungarian dances. These lovely pieces were beautifully played, and the audience seemed very pleased, but putting them at the head of the program simply underlined their relative weightlessness. In fact, they sounded almost trivial. That is what encores are, delightful morsels offered as treats after a demanding workout for the audience. We had had no workout yet. That came next in the form of Schoenberg's Chamber Symphony No. 1, Opus 9. This intricately scored study of dementia reminded me of the many times that I have walked into a room only to find that I've entirely forgotten why I'm there. I do not for a moment accuse Schoenberg of incompetence. He not only knew what he was doing, but, in the venerable tradition of modernism, he anticipated a major social upheaval to come later in the 20th century. To wit, the explosive incidence of Alzheimer's disease. The symphony is studded with several passages of slow, pensive, and beautifully written music, but for the most part it scampers about in willful delirium, violating with the relish of a Hun the most sacred idea of sonata form, lucid progression from here to there. Nor does the symphony possess the creepy, somewhat camp charm of Piero Lunaire. It is just creepy. The mind is a terrible thing to waste. If you doubt me, listen to this music. After the interval, we could finally please just have the Brahms now. From the start, Mr. Bronfman and Orpheus gave us a richly satisfying reading of this immensely ripe chestnut. But one could not simply sit back and enjoy the show. No, one must put one's finger on what distinguished this performance from what one was used to, used as one was to the leadership of those champions of the will to power, conductors. Actually, today's young conductors go to great lengths to dissociate themselves from the grandiose egotism of their predecessors. Where the old dinosaurs commanded, the young people suggest and implore. Nevertheless, the conductor's baton has a certain unifying effect. It keeps the band together. So that is what one listened to at first. Orpheus, however, made a complete red herring out of this issue. It stayed together. There was nothing like the awkwardly fascinating, or fascinatingly awkward, bar-long moment last spring when the strings came apart in the scherzo of Schumann II. That lapse was patched before most listeners noticed it. Tonight, everything flowed as smoothly and imperturbably as is customary at Brahms's fount of German classicism. What one was listening for, the faint blur of uncoordinated disorder that harpies at the Times have been known to complain of in Orpheus performances, just wasn't there. One scratched one's head, for something clearly wasn't right. Expecting as one did the possibility of a train wreck, Orpheus shattered in hubristic assault on big boy repertoire, one was actually slightly annoyed with the charm of the performance, an annoyance that curdled charm into tedium. Where was the excitement? Not the normal excitement that Orpheus so routinely but unflaggingly produces, the excitement of hearing things as if for the first time. One was looking for the far more vulgar, far less aesthetic excitement of big mistakes. There weren't any, and there weren't going to be any. That became clear right away. The members of Orpheus knew what they were doing, and Mr. Bronfman knew what they were doing, too. A more intelligent listener would have seized upon this recognition, that Mr. Bronfman knew and cared about what his colleagues were doing, as the secret to what made this performance unusual, long before one did, which was not until the third movement. One forgets just when it happened, but one recalls that it definitely involved winds and brass, a blend of wind and brass sound poured forth from behind the piano. The notes were perfectly executed, but they were a little louder, a little more insistent than they would have been under the baton of a Bernstein or a Davis. That is, one noticed all of a sudden that such passages were always, and not just occasionally, not just for effect, but always, louder. One was reminded of a remark of Mr. Bronfman's, printed in the program. I want to be part of the group, almost as if I were playing the Brahms piano quintet, with the same type of spirit. That is exactly what was going on, one saw at last. The chamber orchestra was giving a chamber performance of a major orchestral masterpiece. What's the difference? By now, one was not quite so thick-headed. The difference is the focus that a typical conductor will fix upon the concert soloist. What the conductor does to achieve this focus is principally a matter of melding the various orchestral voices into an indissoluble whole, a suggestion of instrumental variety without the reality. Here we have the soloist, there we have the orchestra. Orpheus, far from being shattered, shattered that duality. The result was a great deal more music than one was used to, leaving one with a slight case of Josephine dyspepsia, too many notes. There was nothing rank or weedy about the presentation of each and every one of Brahms's ideas, but it made for a new sound, and I'd like to hear more of it before deciding if, all in all, it is a good sound. If I could not make this determination upon a first exposure, I must plead my own base weakness of character. I let far too much of the concerto go by, as if P.T. Barnum had hired the hall. Mr. Bronfman may have played with all the collegiality of the most self-effacing chamber pianist, but he had the good sense to demonstrate a showman's virtuosity that was always impressive. Under normal circumstances, it would have been dazzling. Mr. Bronfman's playing is all that we would have noticed. There was perhaps a faint discord between his pyrotechnics and the orchestra's steadily glowing illumination. But these are early days in the post-conductor era. In Indiscretions, Jude Law eventually put some clothes on, and the spectacle was over. Nothing like that happened at Carnegie last Tuesday.